Public Safety Committee will come to order. Mr. Keeper, did you want to say something now?
Sure, okay. Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just wanted to introduce a group of high school seniors from Burnsville. They were here to talk to me about House File 142, and they're here to study about the government.
Very good.
You guys can raise your hands.
Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, we members, we have a full agenda for today and unfortunately this evening, but bill deadline coming as it is, so our plan is after civil law concludes at 7:30, we will reconvene. So what can I say? We don't have a lot of bills this evening, so hopefully we will get out relatively early. So with that, our first bill on the agenda is House File 946. I will move House File 946 and with the motion that we recommend it to pass, and it refers to the Committee on Judiciary. Representative Liebling, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. House File 946 is a bill that would give, really, I look at this bill as being about health. This is about making sure that when people are underage and they're drinking or they're doing something they shouldn't be doing and they have a health emergency, that the illegal behavior doesn't keep them from getting the health care that they need. And it's really wonderful that we have these young students here today. I think they should probably have an interest in this bill. I think this is a bill that will tell students in Minnesota that we really care above everything, we care about their health and their lives. And when their parents send them off to college, I think their parents will be comforted to know that we are encouraging students to look out for each other and get them the help that they need. So I'm very pleased to, I'm going to stop talking and let my testifiers talk, and we're going to try to be as brief as we can in consideration of the committee's busy agenda. And so I'm introducing Matt Forstie, who is the chair of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition.
Mr. Forstie, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Forstie. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and I serve as the chairman of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition, which represents students from all five U of M campuses. I want to thank you for hearing this bill today. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 946. I see the need for this change in law because when medical emergencies arise in underage drinking situations, young people hesitate to call 911 because of the fear of prosecution for underage drinking. Underage consumption or possession of alcohol is currently a misdemeanor that typically carries a fine of at least $100. Statistics show that this problem is significant. In a 2011 survey of over 12,000 Minnesota college students conducted by the University of Minnesota's Boynton Health Service, 14% of students that were surveyed indicated that they would be unlikely to call 911 if they were unable to wake someone that had passed out. We want to avoid the potentially tragic outcomes of not getting medical assistance to those that need it. This legislation will help by providing the incentive to call for help by extending immunity from underage consumption and possession of alcohol prosecution when someone seeks help for an immediate medical concern. This bill specifies that both a person that receives medical assistance and a person or a small group of people up to three that called for another person would get this immunity. I want to emphasize that the only crime that someone would receive immunity for under this bill is minor possession or consumption of alcohol, and that no other crimes are covered. I also want to point out that increasing access to help in emergencies like alcohol poisoning isn't the only impact this law could have. It could also help encourage a minor that was assaulted or sexually assaulted while drinking to seek medical help and make a police report right away. Currently, individuals in those situations may decide to wait until they sober up or seek assistance because they believe that they might be prosecuted for underage drinking, or they might even decide to not seek medical help at all. 10 states and hundreds of college campuses across the nation currently have this policy in place, and this bill is modeled off language that has been implemented in other states with a consideration of what is best for Minnesota. While crafting this bill, we've contacted public health officials in the 10 states that have already implemented this bill, and the many responses that we received indicated positive reception for our efforts, and many of those officials in other states that we communicated with expressed that they believe that medical amnesty has reduced hesitation among minors to call for help. This bill is a simple change that will increase access to emergency medical assistance, and simply put, I believe it will save lives. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Who is next? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Taylor Williams. I'm the student body president at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, and I'm originally from Rochester, Minnesota. This bill has widespread support from the community. Students, mayors, council members, and relevant associations all believe that this legislation will save lives. You can find a more comprehensive list of current advocates in the handout you just received. Each day, as we spread the word about H.R. 946 and share our stories of young people placed in jeopardizing situations, support from the community grows. Students are a major stakeholder in this process. I want to specifically note that student support includes representative bodies of the entire University of Minnesota system, MSLC, the Minnesota State Universities, MSUSA, and the Minnesota Association of Student Councils, MASC, which represents all high school student governments. We have worked and communicated with relevant officials and interest groups while crafting this legislation to create the most effective policy for Minnesota. In our state, underage drinking is a serious problem that tens of thousands of young people are exposed to each year. According to the Mayo Clinic, 23% of high school age students have participated in high-risk drinking, also known as binge drinking, in the past 2 weeks. At the collegiate level, over 37% of 20-year-olds have engaged in the same behavior in the past 2 weeks. Whether it is a student who is attending a party and drinking for the first time that becomes ill and needs medical attention, or a young woman who is sexually assaulted and needs to seek help, current state law discourages that individual from seeking assistance. Over the past weeks, I have met with dozens of young people who have been in situations like the ones described today. These situations happen all too often. We need common sense laws that encourage students to get help when they are in danger. While we will never condone underage drinking, we cannot risk lives and dignity in an effort to be tough on students. This law provides a targeted and limited immunity focused on solving a specific problem. It does not overreach and is carefully written to ensure that underage drinking is not encouraged or becomes more prevalent. Educational organizations like the University of Minnesota, for example, will still be able to intervene with their students and undertake corrective action. Furthermore, the law will require individuals seeking help to be the first person to make contact with a police or peace officer, cooperate fully, and provide their name and contact information while staying on the scene. A medical amnesty law in Minnesota will decrease hesitation to seek help and expand emergency access when it is needed most. In 2006, Cornell University published data that shows the effectiveness of medical amnesty. The study showed that alcohol-related EMS calls increased by 22% after the implementation over the first 2 years. During this time, Cornell noted that there was no change in underage drinking rates. The increase in EMS calls reflects an increase in reporting emergency situations. In addition, Cornell surveyed students about the reasons that they did not call for help in alcohol-related medical emergencies. Students citing the reason, "I didn't want to get the person in trouble," decreased 61% over those 2 years. Support this legislation and ensure that we are placing the safety and dignity of young people first. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wants to speak in favor of House File 946? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Drumellum, and I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and I'm also 19 years old. And today I'd like to share an experience of mine that I believe really illustrates the benefit that medical amnesty legislation could provide for Minnesota youth. Last year, my friends and I had been drinking in our dorm before we were planning on going to a party. All of us were underage. We had walked just outside the dorm to wait for a taxi to take us to the party, and as we waited, a group of people across the street motioned my friend to come over to the other side. He crossed the street, and he was then attacked. My friend was clearly hurt and was speaking incoherently. So then we brought him back inside the dorm, and 15 minutes later, he was in the bathroom vomiting. We brought him into his room to lay him down so he could go to sleep, but he continued puking, crying, and it seemed like he had trouble remembering what had even happened and what was happening at the current time. This led my friends and I to believe that he was exhibiting signs of a concussion. We went back and forth yelling about whether or not to take him to the campus emergency room 2 blocks away. I wanted to get him medical attention, but my two other friends were worried that we could all receive minors for drinking. The argument went on for longer than it should have. We were risking further medical complications each minute we spent weighing the mark an underage drinking ticket would have on our future ambitions. Ultimately, I decided that it was in his best interest to seek medical attention for him. After deeming a CT scan necessary, the doctor told my friend that he ought to press charges against his attacker. He told the doctor he would, but he never did in fear of facing legal consequences for having drinking underage. With the assurance that he would have not received an underage drinking ticket, I believe that my friend would have sought justice. In this case, eventually the right decision was made in a difficult situation. However, there was hesitation in making that choice. My friend's health was risked, and it was when it was clear that he needed medical attention. With a medical amnesty law in place, I believe that people in similar situations to mine would not hesitate to get help. This law will encourage young people, who sometimes have lapses in decision-making, to make the right choice. More importantly, it will prioritize safety over minor legal penalties and encourage students to always get help when someone needs it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Hipsch, and I am a senior majoring in finance at the University of Minnesota Carlson School. 2 years ago, I was a community advisor in one of the residence halls on campus. One night, I was patrolling the building with a coworker, and we came across a girl lying on the floor in the bathroom. Her name was Brittany. Brittany was conscious, but she was not coherent. She was stumbling, muttering, and was confused. Brittany was clearly in need of immediate medical attention. Her roommate was in the bathroom with her, and after some coaxing, told us that she and Brittany had been at a friend's house that night, where they had dinner and were drinking wine. Brittany's roommate had never seen Brittany react to alcohol this way and wasn't sure what to do. But she hadn't called emergency medical services because she didn't want she and Brittany to be punished. They were only 19. My coworker and I called for emergency medical services for Brittany, and she spent the next 2.5 days in the hospital as doctors tried to determine what was wrong with her. I am certain that had my partner and I not been walking down the hallway at the moment when we saw Brittany and her friend enter the bathroom, that Brittany would never have gotten the medical attention she needed. This bill helps to remove the barriers currently in place that cause minors to hesitate or to fail to make the right decisions when faced with an emergency. But this incident is not isolated. All too often, people will put their friends into bed without getting them the medical attention they can so desperately need, just because they're afraid to ask for help. My most basic role as a community advisor was to help students and to ensure their safety. But I could not do this when students were apprehensive about approaching me because of the fear of threat of punishment. How many times do people not get the emergency assistance they need because they're hiding behind closed doors and aren't in a public place or a visible area like Brittany was? Students are apprehensive about calling emergency services because of the threat of punishment, the fear of prosecution, or the potential ramifications they could have for making a responsible decision. We need to do what we can to avoid a tragedy. It is our responsibility. I don't know what would have happened to Brittany that night had my coworker and I not found her. Maybe she would have been fine, but maybe she would not have, and that is a decision that we don't want our students making. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions of the witnesses?
I have a question for the author, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling. My question relates, first of all, to lines 1.15 through 1.19. If I'm a police officer who arrives at a party and there's 60 underage kids there and there are a couple that are unconscious, what is to stop an individual student there from seeing the cops arrive, going down and flagging me down to avoid prosecution? Second, understanding that your language of your bill limits it only to the first person, what if several other individuals at that party at the same time see the cops arrive and all dial 911 on their cell phones? Is this going to be a case of competing 911 reports / who talked to the cop first in order to avoid prosecution?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, it's clear that the bill doesn't answer these kinds of questions, and I think it's certainly possible that people will claim to be the first person to avoid prosecution. But I think that the competing interests here, though, we're talking about a minor consumption ticket versus saving somebody's life, and I think the ambiguity in that, I just think that there isn't the risk of that happening, and that if you weigh the consequences here, you're saying, well, somebody can escape a minor consumption ticket versus somebody's life being saved. I think the competing interests are pretty clear, but I'd like to give my testifiers a chance to answer that, because this bill, as this language has been taken from other states, and I don't know if there's experience in that in other states. So,
well, Mr. Chair, before you do that, Representative Liebling, I could ask you the second question. I have two, and maybe your testifiers could weigh in on that. What is to stop if an individual, a police officer, shows up at a party, and either a certain number of underage individuals there claim the need for medical attention and decide that they personally need to go to the hospital now, are they immune from prosecution? Or B, what is to stop me as an underage person from saying that I'm going to accompany the individual who is voluntarily seeking assistance? And what is to stop the 50 other people at the party from saying I'm going to accompany the individual to medical assistance? And does that make them immune from prosecution?
Representative Liebling. Uh-huh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch. Well, under paragraph C, you've got this. It also applies to one or two persons acting in concert. I think it's pretty clear under the bill that 50 people don't get immunity. And you have to be the person initiating contact. So I don't think that this covers a situation where the police show up at a party and then suddenly people say, oh, hello, I need medical attention, I have immunity. I don't think the bill would create that situation, but I'd like to ask our testifiers to answer that.
So, Mr. Williams?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your question, Representative Lesch, and thank you for it. My understanding, based on conversations with other states that implemented this law and law enforcement, is that when a police officer arrives at a party, that is contact. So that police officer has initiated contact, and if a call hasn't been made prior to that occasion or that occurrence, the law could not be invoked. Does that answer your question?
Representative Lesch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it doesn't, because that's not what the bill says. So I'm wondering, maybe, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you know, when you say it's my understanding from other states, this state will apply the law in its own way, and our judges will interpret the law in its own way, and that will take on a culture of its own. Representative Liebling, did you work at all with city attorneys or individuals who prosecute these crimes in order to come to the language that you have here today?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch, the language didn't come from me, so the language came from these young people who have done a lot of background work on the bill, and I understand have made a lot of these contacts.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
I've prosecuted these for going on 12 years now, and students are extraordinarily creative, and good on them to a certain extent. However, the city of St. Paul, which is a college town, it has more colleges in the city of St. Paul than per capita than any city except for Boston in the United States. The neighbors, the city council hear from the neighbors constantly. And I, as a city attorney, hear from students constantly. Many of them have good cases. However, some of them that would fall within the loopholes of this law would be able to be scofflaws. And that's why I ask if the students haven't worked with city attorneys on this, it would be worthwhile, because it does create substantial problems for neighbors, some of whom members of this committee have as constituents, and they would hear from them on that.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me back up there. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Liebling, I like your bill. Of course, I'm biased. I'm co-author of the bill. But I don't see the same fears that Representative Lesch does here. I don't think it restricts from ticketing the person that's in charge of the party, and I don't think kids are going to come flocking out across the lawn to say, I called. I don't see those problems with it, and being in the experiences myself and shutting down these parties, I think that this voluntary request, I kind of agree that once you show up, the cop shows up at the scene, it's too late to come out and fabricate a story. But if there's some comfort language we could put in there to that effect along the way, because I really want your bill to succeed, and I think it's a good idea. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I was taken back by one of the students, and it was just, you know, common sense. And I think one of the issues that we struggle with here is that, are we condoning underage drinking? And that's probably one of the biggest fears. So in understanding the majority of who are here, I'm wondering if you would be amenable to an amendment that would possibly use an age group from 18 to 21, for example, because I think that's really, from a common sense standpoint, majority goes off to college, they're away from home. I think we all understand what happened when we moved the drinking age from 19 to 21. So when we get down into the high school ranks, I think that's all about education, which all of this really is, but we really try and stress education at the high school level is you're not ready. That's not the time. You're just not ready to understand the effects of alcohol. So just a thought, but I know this goes to judiciary, I think, Mr. Chair, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, it does.
A possible amendment there to range just from 18 to 21 might be a thought. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Okay. I'll pass for now. Thank you.
Representative Liebling, did you want to respond to the age issue that Representative Kelly brought up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do. And Representative Kelly, I appreciate that concern, and we certainly will discuss that. It strikes me, though, that even though I do hear your concern, I don't see this bill as condoning underage drinking. And I also think the concerns that were expressed here with the college-age folks apply equally and perhaps with even more force in high school. If there's a medical emergency and my child is involved, I don't care about the ticket. You know, it's like the parent who says, if you're somewhere and you're drinking and you're underage and you're drinking and you get into trouble, you call me and I'm going to come and get you and I won't ask you. It's kind of the state doing that for people, saying, you're our kids and we care more about your life and health than we do about punishing you in a situation where you already know you're doing the wrong thing. And you're in a medical emergency situation where it's sort of its own punishment. If somebody's passed out or having a medical emergency and that's in some way related to drinking, I think there's a big lesson there for the kids who are in that situation already. So I do appreciate that concern. None of us wants to condone underage drinking, and none of us wants to condone excessive drinking. Certainly not me. But we'll certainly give that some thought, however. I appreciate the suggestion.
Representative Neuberger, did you want to say something, or did you pass it? Or did you want to say something?
No, I did. There was we needed to clarify something. Representative Lush and I were having a little powwow here. Question that comes up is, I just need some clarification on, is that currently there are keg registration laws where if you're 21, you buy a keg, you register that keg at the liquor store. We did a really quick search here, and those people would still be held liable. This would not cover the keg registration laws. So if you're having it, if you're 21, you buy the keg, and all your friends are 20 and under, this would not protect you from these keg registration laws. You would still be held accountable, possibly a felony offense for the contributing to a minor. I just wanted to be clear on that point, that this is not amnesty to get you out of the keg registration laws. The way that Representative Lush and I were looking at that seems to be the point. I just wanted to clarify that. So.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Representative Neuberger had was the same issue I had. I wanted to make sure that this bill does not protect the person who obtains the alcohol for this party. I myself have signed on to this bill. I think it's a good idea. But reading it here again today, I just realized that it could, the way it's worded, if the person who supplied the alcohol was the one who called, would he be the one exempt from prosecution for procuring the alcohol?
Yeah, I think this
Representative Mr. Forstie.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think that person would not receive amnesty under this bill or immunity because up in 1.8, lines 1.8 and 1.9, subdivision A, paragraph A, clause 2, and subdivision 3 are only underage possession and consumption of alcohol, so providing to a minor is a different crime that just wouldn't receive immunity.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess more of a comment. I'd like to commend our testifiers here, and you know, I think this bill is a bill that we've all maybe been there or heard stories about this, and it really solves a problem. The overriding issue here is saving a life, possibly saving a life, and I think we're probably all for that. It's an admirable bill. I think it needs a little bit of work. We certainly don't want to condone underage drinking and things like that. But overall, I'm glad that you brought this to our attention. We all know it's a big issue on college campuses and regrettably maybe some high school parties and things like that. It needs to be addressed, and I think this makes law enforcement more of a partner with our young kids that are out there today. So I think it's a good bill. Maybe needs a little work as we go through committees. Thank you.
Zach Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to say this. I think the overriding issue is people in America don't know how to drink responsibly. There's a con bill out that suggests that we allow parents to drink with their children who are not 21 years old yet. I think that we need to start looking at this overall problem. I'd support bringing the drinking age down to 18 in the United States. It must be my time in Europe, but I think it's we need to really look at this as an overarching problem, period. And thank you. Thanks for the time.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in opposition to the bill? Is there any further discussion, questions? Oh, Mr. Franklin. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. This is a problem. There's no two ways about it. This is a problem I have dealt with in my career. I policed a college town as a police chief for over 7 years. This is not a new problem. Secondly, from a law enforcement perspective, some of our concerns have already been raised. I will try to be very succinct and to the point. This does start down a slippery slope of where do we go next on sanctioning what is now criminal behavior. We've already heard alluded to changing the law to 18 so it does not become a criminal behavior. Point two, this bill does not address how many times a week, a month, or a year a student could call, find themselves in this situation, and use this immunity to law. One time is we learn a lesson, or is it once a week? This law does not address any of those things. This law does not address the technicality of an officer that stops a vehicle of which the party then just says, I'm on my way to seek medical attention, which basically nullifies a law enforcement officer's traffic stop of any kind of a violation for possession or consumption. We also have the issue that was alluded to about the keg law. This law does not address evidence that is garnered or taken by law enforcement officers and whether or not that evidence can be utilized in prosecution of another crime. Does this address the search and seizure and the other issues that might be related to it? We have no case law. We don't know. Finally, I would just point out, we as law enforcement officers use discretion all the time. We do not have to charge every kid with underage consumption. And in fact, we don't. I have spoken with the county attorneys and city attorneys in several jurisdictions about their concerns about this particular issue and what they do. And they, as we know, will also agree not to prosecute on varying cases under circumstances. The final point in this bill, it talks about cooperation. It does not define what cooperation is. And we all know that attitude and behavior when confronting an alcohol-related situation in a young person, the variables of what kind of cooperation exists between law enforcement is nebulous. So we just think that this particular bill, while well-intended, is trying to address a problem. We have a number of issues from a law enforcement perspective that we feel will come up. likely could cause more cases to go to court over disagreement. And we also raised the concern that if kids think this is going to be a free pass to drinking, could possibly lead to more alcohol consumption, not less. And that is a concern. My final point is, and I think Representative Liebling addressed that, you should never, ever not call 911 in fear of a ticket. You should call and then be ready to deal with the medical situation. The consequences of all of that can be negotiated and worked out later, but the safety of the individual and the consequences should never come into play. Thank you.
Hang on a second, Mr. Franklin. So did do you know if the County Attorneys Association or the Sheriff's Association have taken a position on the bill, or are you speaking on?
I'm speaking on behalf of the Sheriff's Association. I have talked with several county attorneys and city attorneys individually. As far as I know, neither of those associations have taken a formal position.
Very good. Representative Cornish has a question of you.
More of a comment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's problem is we aren't going to shut down underage drinking. It's just plain going to happen, and we should have, could have, would have, all we wanted to, but I can think of, Mankato has a real problem with this, the town that you were chief in, but after you left. But but we have a real problem that we got a college town there. I think it was listed in a magazine as one of the top partying colleges in the 60s, and it still have, they call it the Bermuda Triangle, where we got 9 bars in a little circle. And I can think of several instances of deaths and injuries there where it's waited until somebody got ran over. Another case where they found the young person in the morning, and another place where they found them unconscious where people have just waited too long. And I got a feeling is that, listen, the underage people, and I don't mean this derogatorily, don't think like older people do. And they have a real fear about their records and about how it affects their college experience, and they don't call in. And so I think that we can do something to avert that and to help them out. And once again, it's not a perfect bill, but I think Representative Liebling and I can work on that in the future and make it workable and allay some of the law enforcement and prosecution concerns. If prosecutors were against it, they should have been here today because it's on the schedule. So. But I mean a formal stance. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom and Kelly, and then we're going to vote on this and move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would strongly encourage you to work with Representative Liebling to address the concerns. I think that the majority of us understand that once the drinking has already happened, we aren't condoning it anymore. We are just trying to pick up the pieces of what has already happened. And ultimately, having young people get medical attention that they need is really, really important. So I would strongly encourage you to work with Representative Liebling between now and my committee.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Franklin, I understand that you believe that, you know, most people in law enforcement will use discretion. But unfortunately, there's many who don't. And young kids know that. A classic example, we live in a rural area. This last summer, kids coming home from college, they're stuck in a pretty strange situation from 18 to 21, really, or 19 to 21, where they've been off at college, and we know that drinking goes on there. So they come home, they get together at a private residence and have a party. All of them are over 18, most of them 19. But they realize that at the bottom of the driveway now is law enforcement waiting for them. Now, the other thing that I believe has happened in colleges is a very good educational promotion where now they actually have drivers that did not partake drinking at all because they were going to get their friends home. Now, at the bottom of that driveway, law enforcement stopped. They PBT'd every single one, and those who drove with the driver who was not drinking at all got the ticket. Others fled. They went into the woods. They went into the cornfields. They actually put their lives in danger because they knew that at the end of the driveway was a ticket for them. That was not, in my mind, discretion because they had rides home. They were safe, but all these people were out. It was dark. It was raining. It was 1, 2 in the morning. So that's the problem. It's perception is reality for these kids. And Representative Liebling, I would just plead with you one more time to say the 18 to 21 I think is a very good idea because I think there's a major difference between kids that have gone off to college, have experienced alcohol, have experienced parties, know what kids look like when they're in trouble. I would strongly suggest that high school kids are nowhere close to that, and our education should be framed all around the effects of it and that they're not ready for it. I think that would be a pretty good amendment to that bill. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Liebling, do you have any closing comments?
Well, thank you, members, and obviously there's further discussion that needs to be had on this bill. I really appreciate all of your comments. I appreciate Mr. Franklin's comments, although I hadn't heard most of them until today, and I think some of them, you know, we can always talk about slippery slopes. Everything we do around here is a slippery slope, but I think the members of this committee understand that we need to do something about this problem. Thank you for hearing the bill.
Okay, so thank you, Representative Liebling, and hope you appreciate some of the comments here as the bill moves forward. So I will move that House File 946 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Next is Representative Allen, House File 485. Representative Allen, welcome to the committee. Welcome to the committee. I will move, the chair will move House File 485 to be, the motion will be that it passes the Public Safety Committee and referred. Where is it? Excuse me one second, Representative. Representative Hillstrom, do you need to hear this bill?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that they spun off the piece that I needed to hear and that I have a separate bill in my possession that we're going to hear on the issue.
Representative Allen, where does the bill go? You make, and then we'll make the motion, because there is a sizable appropriation, but it doesn't come out of this budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's going to Health and Human Services, Finance.
Okay, so Representative Allen, so the motion would be that it pass this committee and go to Health and Human Services Finance?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. So that will be the motion. Again, Representative Allen, welcome to the committee. Members, we've already heard this bill, so I think we can keep some of the presentation hopefully brief and focus more on the changes that are in Article 2 of the bill. Representative Allen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 485 and the No Wrong Door Report, which is included in your committee materials, are the products of 18 months of hard work on the part of service providers, law enforcement, professionals, philanthropy, advocates, and survivors of sex trafficking from around the state. With coordination input from the Department of Public Safety, Health and Human Services, and the financial support of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, it represents the best ideas and best practices from around our state and around the country. The bill will put in place a statewide system of safe and secure shelter, trauma-informed care and services, and comprehensive training for law enforcement and others to effectively identify victims and to aggressively investigate and prosecute cases of child sex trafficking. It is an evidence-based, trauma-informed model. Stopping the trafficking of our children is not only a moral imperative, but also a sound investment for the state of Minnesota. A 2012 cost-benefit study conducted by the University of Minnesota and Indiana State University showed a savings of 34 state tax dollars for every dollar invested in a model like the Safe Harbor No Wrong Door model. Now, I would introduce Michelle Garnett McKenzie, who is from the Advocates for Human Rights, to testify. Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Allen, for moving this forward. My name is Michelle Garnett McKenzie. I am Advocacy Director at the Advocates for Human Rights. It's good to be back before you. And thank you to the many co-authors that we have in the room here. I think many of you are already on this bill, and we appreciate that support. HF 485 completes the work that we started in 2011 with the passage of the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth Act. It creates a system to effectively respond to sexual exploitation of children and really makes it possible for Minnesota to recognize prostituted children as the victims of the felonies that they are, rather than with the continuing ineffective response of delinquency proceedings. As you noted, this committee had the opportunity to hear in detail earlier in the session about the issue of sex trafficking of children and about the No Wrong Door report. Knowing that time is at a premium, I'm happy to answer questions about Articles 1 and 3 relating to the staffing and structure of the overall concept, but in light of this committee's jurisdiction, we'll just simply turn to Article 2. Article 2 would amend Section 260B.007 of Minnesota statutes. It removes all prostituted children under 18 from delinquency proceedings and repeals the diversion program that was created in 2011. Now that we have evidence-based programs ready to meet the needs of victims as they are identified. It is, simply put, a felony in Minnesota to traffic children for sex. It is a felony to engage in the prostitution of a minor under 18. And prostituted children would be recognized as the crime victims that they are under this bill, allowed to get into and partake of the services, housing, and supportive structures that will be in place for them through the No Wrong Door appropriations that will be heard in other committees. So with that, I would conclude my remarks and turn things over to back to Representative Allen or over to Mr. Choi.
County Attorney Choi, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney, and it's great to be here again talking about ending sex trafficking. As I had mentioned earlier when I was before this committee, I really believe that this issue of children being sold online is the greatest human rights atrocity that's happening right before our eyes. As I have testified before, the average age of entry into prostitution is 13 years of age. And as the chief prosecutor, I will tell you, over the course of the past year, we've prosecuted 12 cases involving traffickers who are selling our children. And of those children, what's alarming is that those ages are getting younger and younger. And I want to make sure that it's very clear that that we didn't make no mistake that these children, these victims, are coming from all over the state of Minnesota. They are not children just from St. Paul or Minneapolis, but they are children from throughout the state, throughout greater Minnesota. And I believe that the key to ending sex trafficking is employing a victim-centered approach. And what I mean by that is to, first of all, the first step is to make sure that we understand that people who are coming in the system, we understand who are the criminals and who are the victims. And it's my firm belief, and also the belief of the county attorneys in the 7 county metropolitan area, as well as Olmsted and St. Louis, who have already embraced this policy. But if you are under the age of 18, you are not, and you're being prostituted, you are not a criminal, you are not a delinquent, you are a victim of crime, you are a child in need of protection. And by doing that, what we do is that when police have that mindset, when they interact with a child victim who has been prostituted, who has been sold online, and let's make no mistake about these situations. You all heard the 911 tape that I shared with you involving a case here in Ramsey County. But these children are beaten, they're threatened, and this is no pretty woman scenario. In fact, it's very horrific. And so these children are victims. But when we have that approach that we say that you are a victim of crime, you are a child in need of protection, we start calibrating our response in that regard. And what that does is that we start developing trust with that victim. And ultimately, if we want to hold traffickers accountable, what we really need to do is make sure that we are helping those victims, because at the end of the day, they are the most important witness to hold the trafficker accountable. And just as an example, in Roseville, we had a case involving Samuel L. Cozart, a very, very bad man who was selling a 17-year-old girl from greater Minnesota online. And through the course of this because of the victim-centered approach that the Roseville Police Department took in explaining to her that she would not be prosecuted and that police were there to help her. By the time we got to trial, the 17-year-old girl trusted a police officer named Ben more than she trusted this trafficker who she thought she loved, named Samuel Cozart. And because of her willingness and her ability to testify, we were able to get a guilty plea from the defendant and a sentence of 21 years in prison, which is the longest sentence that I'm aware of for sex trafficking. And so this victim-centered approach does work, and it's something that we're doing already in the seven-county metropolitan area as well as in St. Louis and Olmsted County. So I encourage you to support this bill because it will make a difference. It will make a difference with respect not just with Article 2, but with everything else in it, and I think that we can make a real impact on ending sex trafficking, which, again, I think is the greatest human rights atrocity that's happening in our community. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And next.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I will definitely try to keep it brief. My name is Artika Roller. I am the program director of a program at the Family Partnership called the Pride Program. We are the oldest support service agency for women and juveniles that have been exploited and trafficked. I've been working in this field for a little bit over 9 years. We see approximately 100 or a little bit over 100 juvenile women that are at high risk or have been identified as victims of trafficking. The commercial sexual exploitation of our youth is a pervasive problem in Minnesota. The issue of child exploitation is particularly difficult to address since the girls are most often hidden from public eye. And the girls live with a lot of shame and fear. The families and other adults in their lives don't recognize the symptoms of victimization and the denial of some of us in Minnesota that sex trafficking and sexual exploitation actually happens here in every county, like John Choi just explained. The safe harbor, no wrong door model is critical because assisting youth to escape exploitation requires a system of services that are not in place in most community. It requires coordination from the courts, law enforcement, and service providers in behavioral health. One of the things that we had seen with some of the young women that we are working with is that because we know that they're victims, in order to keep them safe, they actually have been detained in the juvenile justice system. We worked with one girl. I would say her name is Bonnie, not her actual name, but Bonnie had been exploited since the age of 15. Regarding Article 2, when she turned 17, she didn't have an option to not be trafficked or sexually exploited anymore. She was still exploited by her trafficker. Once her trafficker was picked up, she needed to be safe. She could not return home. Her trafficker's reach had intimidated her family. So she was incarcerated, for lack of a better word, for 8 months while the trial was going on. One of the things that she said to her advocate during those 8 months of services that we provided for her while she was in the juvenile detention center, she looked at her advocate and she said, "I'm not bad. I'm not a bad girl. I didn't know that this was going to happen to me." There is no other victims that we actually put in jail to protect them while we're trying to prosecute their cases. So this is why the safe harbor law and the no wrong door model is very important. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay, appreciate it. Is there any more testimony? Please introduce yourself for the record. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sergeant Grant Snyder. I'm a detective with Minneapolis Police. I'm the lead investigator in all of our sex trafficking, human trafficking cases in Minneapolis. Prior to me talking, County Attorney Choi referred to mindset and talked about the significance of mindset in communication with the victim, and also I think he was referring to police officers. I will tell you from my experience in doing this for many years and dealing with literally hundreds of victims over the course of my career that mindset is the single biggest encumbrance that we as law enforcement face in dealing with the problem of sex trafficking. Mindset in behalf of the police, mindset in behalf of the public, mindset on behalf of the victims. And it refers to ideology and how we look at the victims. Now, myself, my very experienced colleague, Sergeant John Bannerman, who's in the office here today, or I'm sorry, in the audience here today, we have a particular way that we approach this. We know that if a victim comes to one of us, we're going to treat that child as a victim, whether she's 15, whether she's 12, or whether she's 17 years old. Because we've heard the stories and we understand what the backdrop against which they ended up in that hotel room or in that trafficking environment was. Many police officers throughout the state and even across the nation are not going to have the benefit of having listened to a victim's stories, having learned about the abuse, having heard about the coercive factors that go into creating that victim and creating the experience that they've had. So a part of the significance of this law for me is to truly make it official that we're going to, as a state, recognize their status as victims, regardless of their age, as long as they're under 18 years old, taking into account the many factors that go into putting them in that situation in the first place. We talk about abuse, we talk about coercive factors, we talk about force. Just from the standpoint of them being in that situation, being a runaway on the street, and you're 16 or 17 years old, and you've got nothing, your body becomes your currency. That's an inherently coercive situation for them. And they all tell us the same thing. They tell us that they hate what they're doing, that it makes them feel terrible, that they're only doing it for the money, and they'd do anything else if they could. Those are powerful words coming from a child under 18 years old who's out in the street or in a hotel room and who's selling themselves for sex or being sold for sex. I would present to you that those are true words. When they use terms like imprisonment or force or can't get out, those are words that are used by a victim. Those aren't words used by an offender. And the other part of this is that this law wouldn't be necessary if the very first time that we had contact with these children as law enforcement, that we knew we would be able to rescue them and they would never end up back in that situation. But that simply, unfortunately, isn't the case. Case in point, I recently did a rescue on a girl named Bobby. She was with another girl who was 15 years old. Bobby was 17. And we would rescue Bobby three times over the course of 2 months before she ended up getting into a program that was able to finally keep her out of that life. So this is a repeat process for many of them, and we know that that's what we expect because of the fact that their mind is so bent by these traffickers, by these pimps, by the people that abuse them. It takes a long time to reach in there and we have to keep pulling them back out, telling them that they're not going to be prosecuted, telling them that they're victims, and trying to get them to break the chains that they have with these traffickers and the affiliations that they have with the people that abuse them. So I strongly support this measure. As law enforcement, again, in the Twin Cities here, we are already in practice treating them as victims when they're 16 and 17 years old. And I think that this just makes it much more consistent across the state so that we can count on the rest of law enforcement to be able to pass that same message on to the victims.
Questions. So I'm just curious, Representative Allen, or maybe it's more to Ms. Roller. I mean, how since we don't have we're hoping to get the appropriation here to provide more resources, or I'm not even sure if it's to Sergeant Snyder. The question is you're seeing women, young girls repeatedly being arrested. Without the services, how are we really getting? I mean, because I'm assuming you don't have the resources to reach all of these girls. So if the appropriation isn't made, how are we going to really make a dent in this?
You know, you're definitely correct. There is currently 4 shelter beds for traffic victims in the whole state of Minnesota. You know, what we have is a community that is committed to doing this work, and if we don't get the appropriations, unfortunately, we won't have the resources to add beds and shelters for trafficked victims. And what happens is that we build informal relationships with service providers, but when that service provider leaves, we no longer have the additional beds. So that's why the appropriation is just really critical for this bill and for this model to move forward.
Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. This bill places the director into the Department of Health. I was wondering why the reasoning behind that versus public safety or human services or something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll pull my boat over here. I'm very short. My feet don't actually touch the floor, so this is kind of a challenge. You can't see that, but this really represents a change in how all of our approach statewide has been made to human trafficking. Recently, the Human Trafficking Task Force that was housed originally and established in under the Department of Public Safety has moved to the Department of Health as well. They're eager to have this within their approach around sexual violence prevention and as part of their overall strategy as using a public health approach. The reason for that has been propelled largely by the evidence that we've seen from particularly the Ramsey County Runaway Intervention Program that uses a public health approach to intervention with those victims. And it's been incredibly effective, and that's the reason behind this.
Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Representative Savick.
Yeah, I have one question. Once they go into a safe harbor, how long are they kept there, and what resources are given to them so that they can effectively change their life?
Ms. McKenzie.
Thank you. Representative Savick. The No Wrong Door is, as Sergeant Snyder explained, it's a process. And so the philosophy behind it is to meet the victim where they are. That might be somebody who is on the verge of being exploited, someone who has just been exploited a very short time, or somebody who's been deeply embedded in this, and the response will be very different. The idea, though, is that this is not some sort of diversion program that is based on punishment of those victims and they have to comply with it. Rather, it's a kind of a spectrum of intervention that's available to them as they need it, from something that's very informal to something that might be as extreme as going into the Child Protection and Welfare Service.
So,
Representative Savick.
Excuse me. Thank you. So what resources are they provided? Like, are they given job training or counseling on how to get jobs or how to even react with people?
Ms. McKenzie.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you for that question as well. This is really evolving, and we have some amazing service providers like the Pride Program, like Breaking Free here in St. Paul, that have developed very sophisticated responses for these kids, and others is emerging. What the No Wrong Door approach really has identified is a framework to start developing these responses. So I can't answer specifically what services would be available, but it's because that will be developed, hopefully by the statewide director, to really identify all of those things that you mentioned, counseling, medical intervention, on to job training, and getting kids back in school, a whole range of interventions. But that would be developed really in coordination with both the statewide director and the regional navigators that are being established, so that they would be able to draw fundamentally on the resources already available in their community.
As a
Representative Savick.
Yeah, just a comment. As a former foster parent, I know that a lot of children that have went through major problems in their life do not mature as fast as other children. So, and in fact, we adopted one. So, you know, in their early 20s, they're like a teenager. So that's just a comment.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add that there's a $2 million appropriation for Safe Harbor Supportive Services Fund, and that'll be a grant based funding for services that are therapeutic and then also culturally specific. Okay. And I believe that not enough resources are devoted to that currently.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kiefer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the idea, and I want to get these knuckleheads, pimps out of here, and it bothers me to hear these stories. So I do want to find solutions. My only concern is with the whole idea is I don't want to have unintended consequences and have Minnesota become a magnet for runaway teenagers. So I wonder how you, or if there's a plan, or have you guys talked about potentially teenagers coming from Iowa, Wisconsin, going, oh, go to Minnesota, you'll have these places to stay, and I'll help you and get you workforce development. I hope that wouldn't be happening, but I hope that that conversation has been brought up a little bit. Thank you.
Who wants to? Does someone want to respond to that, Sergeant?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. That's a great question. I appreciate it. In my own evolution through this process of supporting this legislation, I've come a long way, and I've had to ask those same questions of myself. From a law enforcement point of view, I don't want Minnesota to become a national dumping ground for runaways to come here because of the decriminalization. And it's difficult as a police officer for me to sit up here and tell you that I believe in decriminalizing anything. But the reality of it is that this legislation supports such a shift, an ideological shift in the way that we deal with these victims. The effect, since we've started on this path of treating them as victims and using a more victim-partnered approach, has been outstanding in our ability to prosecute these cases, to identify the offenders, and to target the people that are the true traffickers in all this and the true offenders. I think you used the right word when you said knucklehead. There's a few other words I could share with you if you want to meet after, but I don't want to say it here in open forum. But the reality of it is that I can't tell you that it will inhibit people from coming here, but I don't see any evidence or reason to believe that it will make more of them come here. We are so aggressive, and the simple fact that what this does is it places immediately at odds with the traffickers. It places the victims at odds with the traffickers. Right now, the traffickers create these conspiracies that protect themselves. They make the victims post the ads. They make the victims drive themselves to these places or get a ride from some other victim or something like that. So the traffickers have tried to insulate themselves. We're removing an encumbrance in our ability to gain their trust and cooperation. So I hope I answered your question.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Very good. Representative Allen, closing comment. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in opposition to this bill? Representative Allen, closing comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we'll conclude our presentation. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So the Chair will renew his motion to pass House File 485 and re-refer it to the Committee on Health and Human Services. Any discussion? Finance, sorry. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
Representative Cornish. While Representative Cornish is getting to the witness stand, just throwing this out here as a possibility, we have this room until 12:30. We have several bills on the agenda. Do members have other places they need to be? Okay. I just thought we could avoid an evening thing, but just a thought.
What was the answer?
It looks like people have other commitments at 11:30, so we'll just go as long as we can. Let's check in at 12:30 and see where people are at. But Representative Cornish, welcome to your committee. Do you want to move House File 1226?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1226 to be recommended to pass and move to the Judiciary Policy and Finance.
Very good. You want to introduce tell us what the bill does?
Mr. Chair, members, what this bill does in layman's terms is there's a statute right now, 609.185, murder in the first degree, and what this bill does is simply place prosecuting attorney and the definition there, and what my witness will go over of what a prosecuting attorney is putting that in the same statute that creates a first degree murder penalty for someone who kills or attempts to kill or assaults a prosecuting attorney or correctional guard, that it puts it into the statute with correctional guard and a peace officer. Up until now, that it's still not in there. Just a little history on this. Last year, we went to, was it 2 years ago? Was it 2 years ago? 11. We passed this through committee and onto the floor. It only received one negative vote on the floor, and it didn't have a fiscal note, and then it got hung up in the Senate and didn't finally pass. So House File 1226, that's where it is, and moving from here to Judiciary, and I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Backstrom, who will explain why the need for it and what has happened in the past to justify the creation of this legislation proposal. Thank you.
Mr. Backstrom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors and a past president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association strongly supports this legislation, as do I. Attacks on prosecutors in our state and across our country may be more rare than attacks upon our law enforcement partners, but they are no less serious, and they do, in fact, occur. I myself was a victim of an attempt on my life within the last 2 years by someone who was convicted of drug dealing in my neighborhood, who blamed me for ruining his life and attempted to hire someone while he was in prison to have me murdered. In Cook County in December of 2011, as you may recall, Cook County Attorney Tim Scannell was shot and almost killed in his own office following a conviction of a sex offender in his community. Earlier this spring, an assistant district attorney in Texas was gunned down on his way to work. Several years ago, an assistant Colorado district attorney was killed for the work that he does. You know, prosecutors in our system play a unique role. We're the accuser. We file criminal accusations in cases, many of which are highly emotional and disturbing incidents of violence, all of which threaten criminal penalties, often including the possible loss of freedom through incarceration. You know, county attorneys also represent the state in adult and child protection proceedings and child support enforcement actions. And these family-related civil proceedings also are often highly charged emotional situations, which can focus anger upon the person trying to take a child from a parent or to enforce other obligations. While prosecutors must respect a suspect's or a defendant's and a defendant's constitutional rights and presumption of innocence, it's our duty to bring forth accusations and evidence to prove a defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We are the only person who stands in court, in open court, asking for the jury to convict and return a verdict of guilty against the defendant. The prosecutor often becomes the focus of a defendant's rage against society for holding them accountable for what they've done. As a society, we ask our prosecutors to hold individuals accountable for breaking our laws and place them in power and authority to make these accusations and to bring these cases forward without fear, without favor towards anyone, but our safety needs to be protected as well. An individual who assaults and kills a prosecutor should rightfully face an additional penalty for attacking not only the individual, but in attacking our system of justice. Just as attacks upon police officers occur, the community suffers from these assaults and attacks and crimes against our public officials. So we would respectfully request to be added to the list of other public officials, peace officers, and correctional deputies who are afforded extra protections under our laws for the difficult jobs that we do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. I have a question. I was just asking staff, and I don't know if they found it, but and Representative Cornish, maybe you know the answer to this. You know, I mean, we've talked about the bill. I'm generally okay with it, but, you know, it's sort of like, when do we stop adding, you know, like, I don't know, as judges, are judges protected delineated in a different statute, and we can't seem to find it? I'm just wondering if you know the answer to that, or if there's other people in the system that then would come forward to ask for this language also. Mr. Backstrom?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe judges are currently covered under the law. I believe perhaps they should be, because the attempt on my life was also an attempt upon the judge's life who was involved in the trial as well. But, you know, you raise a good point, but I do think you can draw the line with the people who are, you know, enforcing our laws and directly involved in our system of justice, and those are the people that I believe deserve the type of protection that's being requested in this bill.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Attorney Backstrom and Representative Cornish. I support the bill.
If anything, though, it may not go far enough in my mind in one sense. You mentioned Mr. Backstrom, the prosecuting attorney in Texas, who was attacked on his way to work. As I read this, and this is maybe a structural underlying problem with just the current law, it talks about, for example, on line 1.22 and 1.23, while these delineated people are engaged in the performance of their official duties, I don't know that that would then apply to the guy who is on his way to work. I mean, it's not like he's in the courtroom. And maybe that's best left for a different bill. But I guess for all of these folks, you know, I can see a peace officer being targeted at home or any of these folks being targeted at home. So if that is a problem, maybe that's something to address in a different bill. But that's all I want to say. I support the bill.
We had another message here, too. It's probably, I don't want to deal with it in this committee, but since it's going to judiciary, there is language here that's probably antiquated and should be amended also on the use of the word guard, since we use correctional officer, I believe, in statute. So we might want to just change that at some point, too. We'll have to do it in this committee. Okay, any questions of Representative Cornish or his testifier? Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Representative Cornish, you want to renew your motion? And also,
Chair members, yes,
Representative Cornish, I don't believe there's a cost to this. Is that correct? Well,
Mr. Chair and members, a fiscal note has been requested on this bill. It's not yet been completed. Generally, the agency that gets the ball rolling on these types of bills is Sentencing Guidelines, and they presume that there will be very few convictions under this statute, but that it will not make new sentences. It will just make current sentences longer. Since the fiscal note only looks at a four-year period, it is unlikely that there would be any cost put in by corrections on this bill.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just like to note that last year's fiscal note did come in as zero.
Very good. Representative Cornish?
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1226 be recommended to pass and move to the Committee of Judiciary Policy and Finance.
Very good. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Cornish. We're going to keep going here till 11:30, I guess. Representative Simonson. So we're not. Representative Simonson, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to recommend House File 669 to pass and be referred to the General Registry.
Very good. Representative Simonson, you want to tell us what your bill does?
House File 669, Mr. Chair and members, is an agency bill and a simple policy updates that will allow for the expansion of the statewide radio board to include the latest interoperable emergency communication technology, to include 911 and wireless broadband for public safety, as well as allowing those federally recognized tribal governments at their request to be integrated into the regional radio board structure. These changes do not impact the 911 fee. And in terms of support for this bill, we have statewide and regional radio boards, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Minnesota Police Chiefs, Minnesota Fire Chiefs, Minnesota Ambulance Association, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No fiscal impact anticipated, and I also have with me Jackie Mines from the Department of Public Safety to make a few very brief comments.
Ms. Mines?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jackie Mines. I'm the Director of Emergency Communication Networks, which is a division of the Department of Public Safety. Our division is responsible for collecting the 911 fee, which funds the statewide armor system or the radio system and the 911 network. And we are also looking at the initiatives brought forth for wireless broadband for public safety. The statewide radio board consists of stakeholders that use the 911 and the armor system. There are seven regional radio boards around the state that feed input into the statewide radio board. This board is made up of the users of the system, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, police chiefs, fire chiefs, ambulance, and commissioners. This board has been very successful in creating standards on the use of the system, so there is on the armor system, and it has been successful in bringing forth funding strategies and legislative initiatives to support this large initiative. And we would like to replicate that for 911 and wireless broadband for public safety. 911 has been relatively simple in that there were just one way to do this kind of network and there were two vendors in the state. However, with the new era of technology, there's a lot more options and we have more choices that we need to make. It is very important that those choices are made with input from those who use the system. With that, I conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Mines. Any questions? Doesn't appear to be. Representative Simonson, you want to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will renew my motion that House File 669 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Registry.
Very good. All those in favor of that? Any discussion? Does anyone want to speak in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you. Just conferring with Representative Cornish, if you're okay with this, we only have a few very non-controversial bills left. If you want to come back at 7:30?
No.
If people have to go, you can go. If we have a quorum, and okay, let's go.
That's ambitious, Mr. Chair.
What? Representative Simonson, do you want, or who do we? Rep. Rosenthal.
I'm flexible.
No, that's fine. Let's keep going here. We have a couple other armor bills here too. Representative Rosenthal, you welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this bill has to make other stops or not, but I would like to move that House File 997B. I'm looking for guidance on where it should go.
There's no waiting for Mr. Wells to come back, but for now, let's say it's we'll say it's going to the General Register.
Sounds good, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 997 requires the statewide radio board to conduct a study on long-term funding for statewide public safety communications. The study requires that the SRB include recommendations on allied radio matrix for emergency response, otherwise known as ARMOR, and 9/11 systems. The study allows for communication systems, other communication systems, to be considered as well, broadband. The SRB is directed to study a wide variety of options and make substantive assessments and evaluations on the possible funding strategies. The results of the study should be due to the legislature on January 15, 2014. House File 97 is widely supported by public safety community and provides a platform for a thoughtful discussion regarding future funding strategies for ARMOR, 9/11, and broadband. This bill is supported by Metropolitan Emergency Services Board, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Association of Minnesota Counties, Minnesota Intercounty Association, Minnesota Chiefs of Police, and Minnesota Ambulance Association. So with that, I will stand for questions.
Do you want your witness to Mr. Tuma? Or?
Mr. Chair, John Tuma with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Really quick, so just, I think, cover Mr. Walls's area. The Statewide Radio Board does receive $1 million appropriation through our normal ARMOR funding, and that will be what covers this study. That's what that money goes for, is studying the system. My understanding is that the present chair of the Statewide Radio Board supports moving forward with this study. They have not met since the bill has come out, but it's my understanding they're going to proceed with this anyway. So in a sense, what you're doing is asking them to report what they're already going to be doing with the money they already have. And so I don't think there's any fiscal impact on the state for this. It's already there. The money is there to be appropriated. They're going to do it. And we support this as counties to go ahead and require this to happen. This makes the system function better as we move into the next generation of systems. So I don't think it has any fiscal impact from your state budget perspective.
There he is. Do you know how much, Representative Rosenthal, that the study will cost?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Tuma.
Representative Rosenthal. They don't know yet. Obviously, they would put out requests for bids for an external study to be done. So.
Mr. Walsh, do you have?
Mr. Chair, members, after just speaking with Ms. Mines in the audience, she anticipated it might be somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000, but the radio board has an annual allotment of $1 million to spend on expenses.
Well, I don't know about that annual allotment. It's in a special revenue fund, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that's part of the department's appropriation from the special revenue fund.
Representative Kelly, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious. I mean, it sounds like it's going to be done. The statewide board says they're going to do it. The county supports it. It's funded. I'm just curious, do we really have to do this legislatively? I mean, we can invite them back to tell us the results. We usually get a pretty good response when we ask groups to do that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, we think, yeah, from the county's perspective, that it does need to be done. We've had probably some miscommunications, maybe partly on our fault, too, as the system has been developed out. And so I think it was an area where all of the different interesting groups who were nipping at each other here about a month ago have come around this language and said this is really a piece in the valley legislation, and I think it would help us that the legislature also wants to participate in this moving forward. There are a lot of costs that you'll be facing with regards to some of these things that are not going to be coming out of the special revenue fund. So I think you're going to want to know what our recommendations are, and you may have a different opinion. So I think it's wise that you ask for it, and it helps move it forward. It has not been approved by the radio board yet, and so I think it sends a very solid message for those of us who are partners in this that this will be done and that we can feel comfortable about it going forward, so that we're not trying to ask you for other solutions over the next few months that may clog up your calendar.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Tuma, I guess I misunderstood, because I thought you said that the board was going to do it, and that's where I took that from. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Mr.
Kelly.
Mr. Tuma, can you just try to go through the chair so we can do
Mr.
this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, that is our understanding from the chair of the board. He has not brought it to the board, and they have not met since we've talked about this.
Thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
All right, so any further discussion? So, Representative Rosenthal, you want to renew your motion then?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to refer House File 97 to pass and be referred to the General Register.
Is there any discussion? Okay, so the motion is that the House File 997 will be passed by the Public Safety Committee and referred to the General Register. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Next, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick because I'm standing between members and lunch. I'll move that House File 1043 be recommended to pass and placed, I believe, on the General Register. I don't know if Representative Hillstrom had requested this or not. I didn't think so, but okay. So that's my motion. If I may, Mr. Chair, you know, you can probably read for yourself in the bill summary what the bill does. The bottom line is that it enhances penalties and allows prosecutors to charge an individual with a felony, obviously optional, if the individual intentionally reports a fictitious emergency with the intent of getting an emergency response, and if the responder or someone else is seriously injured or killed. Now, you might think this is just the stuff of movies, but in California, and most recently as last Friday in Louisiana, their statewide police had to put out an alert statewide in Louisiana to this growing kind of trend of intentionally throwing law enforcement off the trail by making knowingly phony and false 911 calls, particularly in smaller police departments where, at least the thinking goes, they can make these phony and fake 911 calls, cause disruption, cause the deployment of resources to one area of a city or town or area, and then, of course, make mischief in another area. So this has the support of the Sheriff's Association, the Minnesota Police Chiefs, and the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I just have one testifier who can speak for himself.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pete Eggeman. I'm the Director of 911 Services for the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board. Part of our responsibility is to manage the 911 system in the nine counties here surrounding the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Prior to working for the board, I had over 18 years in law enforcement, two terms of which as a county sheriff. And so I've been involved in public safety most of my life. This bill relates to giving the law enforcement and the prosecutors more tools to deal with a growing problem. Our 911 system was designed in the 20th century, and we're trying to deal with 21st century communications technology. And in the process, our system has become vulnerable in certain aspects, some of which are being exploited by people whose sole intent is to report an incident falsely. They're trying to get the law enforcement, in most cases, to respond with a SWAT team to a wrong address, unsuspecting people in the house, with the intent, to get the SWAT team to break down the door and, some sort of an assault on the house itself. As you can imagine, if you were putting yourself in that situation in the middle of the night, your door gets broken down and there's a bunch of police officers arriving in their full SWAT gear, that's a serious situation. Beyond which you have to deal with the risks inherent in an emergency response in the first place. Car accidents, all that could be involved in that. And this bill would allow for the prosecutors to seek a felony charge under those circumstances where someone was injured or hurt. It's a serious issue. It should be taken seriously.
Mr. Chair.
Any questions of Mr. Eggman, Representative Simon?
Mr. Chair, I think the cleanest thing to do is to withdraw my motion and then renew a different motion.
Very good.
If I might.
You want to do that now?
Sure. I'll make the motion that House File 1043 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. The chair of that committee, who sits on this committee, has informed me that because of some sentencing guidelines issues, it does need to go there. There is, by the way, no, as of yet, no fiscal note.
Any questions of Mr. Eggman or of Ms. Representative Simon? Okay, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in opposition to the bill? Okay, so Representative Simon, you want to renew your motion one more time?
I'll renew the motion that House Bill 1043 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy.
Very good. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. We have one more bill, or are we done? Can I just get someone to move the minutes of March 7th?
So moved.
Representative Cornish makes that motion. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? We're adjourned.